Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Is that the end of this case?
How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Start with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all next.
Welcome to episode 149 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. As we warned in recent weeks, the cases might start to slow down a bit as we hit the Memorial Day holiday in summer. Also, there's an Illinois Judicial Conference this coming week, so a lot of slowness. We have two cases today. Like Ernie Banks, we'll play two, but next week...
Not three. Ernie never played three, I don't think.
He never played three. And... next week will be our 150th at milestone, and hopefully we'll have cases to actually discuss on that episode. So we'll see.
We'll see. And maybe I don't expect much from the Illinois Appellate Court, but I could be wrong. But we don't have anything from the United States Supreme Court, but we might have stuff from the Seventh Circuit in Indiana. We'll see.
We'll see. We'll monitor and hope to find at least a couple of cases. With that, our first case today is Illinois Appellate Court First District, Galovitz versus Matus Restoration, Matus. Our second case is Safeco Insurance Company of Indiana, as subrogee of Ramona Smith versus Michaelis Corporation from the Indiana Appellate Court. Let's turn to our first case. Can a plaintiff proceed in Illinois File 1 case, 18L3246, voluntarily dismiss that case? And while the first case is pending, file a new case, 18L3805, get it dismissed with prejudice.
Dismissed for want of prosecution.
Dismissed for want of prosecution. After the voluntary dismissal of 18L3246, and then move to refile 18L3805 under 735 ILCS 5/13217, have that denied, and then on a motion to reconsider, raise 735 LCS 5/2-1401. That is the issue to be addressed when the Illinois Appellate Court First District decides Galovitz versus Matus Restoration, and it sounds like a civil procedure examination. Final. The plaintiff sued for alleged issues with the construction of a home and filed identical complaints. Hilarity then ensued. The circuit court dismissed the 18L3805 suit and then found that while res judicata did not apply to bar the lawsuit. The court found that the one refiling was already done, and therefore the dismissal for want of prosecution of the 18L3805 cannot be vacated. Pat, tell us about oral argument in this civil procedure final exam.
Yeah, this week, Dan, we're going to reach back into the annals of the show. You mentioned we're coming up on 150. When we get to our prediction sure to go wrong, we're going to talk about a case that took nearly 2 years following oral argument. But reaching back even further, to episode 4, we discussed Eigner versus Tiernan, which was discussed in this case. Yep. So Eigner versus Tiernan, if you recall, this is a case in which the Supreme Court exercised supreme largesse to the plaintiff. Plaintiff's a lawyer, really, because plaintiff's going to get paid. In these cases, plaintiff's going to get paid. The question is whether they're going to get paid by the defendant or by their lawyer's malpractice carrier. Those are really the issues here. As we mentioned last week with Justice Lavin, in a case where a lawyer screwed up, at least from his perspective.
So
in Eigner, so I want to set this up by talking about Eigner, because Eigner really, I think, has something to say here. So in Eigner, the plaintiff filed a complaint. It was voluntarily dismissed with leave to refile. And then instead of filing a new suit under 13-217, the lawyer filed a notice of refiling, which was improper. And the court said, yeah, that's improper. Don't do it that way. But we're going to exercise our supervisory authority and reinstate the case anyway. Okay, so that's the largesse that the Supreme Court has the absolute authority to do, as they have the complete supervisory authority over the judicial branch. They can do that. So they did. Okay. So how does that affect what we have here? Well, we have here not a failure to communicate, but a failure to properly file. So we get lawyer files suit one. His clerk apparently mistakenly, because of miscommunication, whatever, files suit two. Suit one gets voluntarily dismissed while suit two is still pending. Then suit two gets DWP. Now, the question is, can they file another one? The plaintiff says, well, I can file another suit. And the defendant, you know, argued slippery slope. Is like, how many refilings do you get? The law says you get one refiling, not three, not 10, not 35. The suggestion was, is that if the plaintiff's right, they get like 35 refilings. I get their point, but I mean, how many times do you get to refile? The real issue here, though, is that when the plaintiff tried to deal with the DWP, they didn't deal with it the right way. They should have filed, they filed a motion to reinstate under 13-217. And what 13-217 does is it allows you to file a new suit. That'd be suit number three. It doesn't let you vacate the DWP. To vacate the DWP, you need to file either a 1301 petition or a 1401 petition. Now, a DWP in this circumstance became final because it was a second refiling upon a second filing, rather, upon 30 days. Now, normally in your first filing, the DWP isn't final until 13 months after. That's 30 days after the DWP plus a year for the assuming the statute has run, plus a year. So 13 months typically in those circumstances, in which case you have to file a 1401 petition, which is why what they needed to have done is when the DWP occurred and more than 30 days had run, they needed to have filed a 1401 petition from the beginning. They didn't do that. They filed it as part of a motion to reconsider. What I don't understand is what they could have done is a 1401 petition is like a new action. Is why file it as part of a motion to reconsider? Just file it as a separate motion. I don't know why they didn't do that. I suppose they could have. It would have been best if they did it right from the beginning. It no doubt would have been granted. Those are in this kind of circumstance of a DWP, even if it's longer than 30 days, those are usually granted as a matter of course, by Illinois courts and certainly in Cook County. But this is really a lesson in what not to do. It's a cautionary tale for everybody. It's funny. I had a colleague of mine come in to my office and ask me a question. I say my office, it's really a conference room I have, but in my office. They're building the office next door, so I'll have an office soon. I hope. But it comes into the place where I have my office, and he says lays out some facts not dissimilar from this, and I'm like, yeah, they got time to do what they did. They're okay. Plaintiff has done it right, and you know, I see the issue you've raised. I see the point you've made, but unfortunately or fortunately, you're gonna have to try this case on the merits. The plaintiff is doing this the right way. It seems the plaintiff could have done it the right way here, just didn't. The plaintiff's likely to be left with a malpractice action in all likelihood against these two lawyers who are going to probably point the finger at each other. It'll be a real mess in that case, as the lawyer who came in later, he claimed that he had difficulty in getting the prior lawyer's file, difficulty in getting cooperation, ultimately got an affidavit to assist with what happened. Didn't seem, however, to get much sympathy from the panel because of how and when the issues were raised. In terms of, well, why didn't you raise it as 1401? Why'd you move under 13-217? 13-217 is not a refiling statute, just as 1009 is not a refiling statute. 13-217 can be, but not in this circumstance. In Eigner, that was the right way to do it. It would have been 13-217, but not in this circumstance. You've already refiled once. Plaintiffs don't get an unlimited number of refilings is the idea here. If you recall back to the mid-90s tort reform, one of the statutes that they amended was this statute, 13-217. And that was struck down as part of the Taylor versus Best Motor Best versus Taylor that struck down that tort reform as unconstitutional because it dealt with more than one subject, yada yada. But it's still on the website. And when my colleague came in the other day, he asked the question. I pulled up the statute and I mistakenly initially read the unconstitutional portion, which would have been very helpful because it would have been very clear what they couldn't do. Would apply here, would apply there, you know, knock out these cases. But that is not that is not the law. The amazing thing is nearly 30 years since that tort reform, those statutes are still on the books and they haven't been repealed. I don't know why the General Assembly just doesn't repeal them and get them off the website. It's very confusing when you read the portions of the Code of Civil Procedure that were amended by that statute that was struck down in 1997. It's 2023, people. Can we please amend the Code of Civil Procedure and take this confusing stuff out? Anyway, Dan, what are your thoughts?
I think you covered it, Pat. You know, I think that there has to be a limit to how many times you can replead and plead for the efficiencies of the court, right? Otherwise, you could have plaintiffs that just constantly test any kind of theories they had, get them bounced, come back, and you'd never have, you know, until the statute of limitations ran, you would never have closure for these cases. So, and I agree with you with the legislature, but I think if you look at probably all the codes in Illinois, as we've talked about, that process of how they actually create the bills is not designed to remove stuff because they'd have to have a shell bill that they could then substitute that might not be in conformance with the three readings and all that stuff. And then
this one they could pull off. They did it with the six person jury thing. They repealed that.
I know.
They could accomplish this.
They could, but yeah, they just don't seem like anybody down there is focused on these types of issues. So
no, it just makes the practice of law difficult because you pull up these statutes and you have to read it's the part with and the part without the unconstitutional stuff. Right. So it's like, oh, your head wants to spin. And the wrong stuff shows up first. That's right. The real problem. So buyer beware when you go on the website to try to look at these things. So with that, we'll take our leave and come back for segment two. And we will discuss Safeco versus Michaelis Corporation, I think it is.
Michaelis.
There was a lot of mispronunciation at the oral argument. We'll get to that.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
We're back for segment two of episode 149 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. And is there a cause of action for negligence or spoliation by a subrogating insurer against a contractor engaged by an insured that destroyed the scene and the product that allegedly caused the fire? That is the question to be answered when the Indiana Court of Appeals decides Safeco Insurance Company as subrogee of Ramona Smith versus Michaelis Corporation. A fire occurred at Smith's property that was allegedly damaged as a result of a defective dehydrator. The kitchen and the area of the fire were marked off with caution tape. Michaelis was hired by Smith to remediate, and Michaelis demolished the kitchen and the allegedly defective product. Hello. We kind of needed that.
Yep.
Safeco, Smith's insurer, filed a subrogation action against the product manufacturer and seller. Safeco also sued Michaelis for spoliation and negligence. The trial court dismissed Michaelis on a 12B6 motion. Dan, tell us about the oral argument.
Thanks, Pat. And one of the things this reminded me of was about a week or so ago, ABC on Instagram has like little stories and stuff. And so I saw a little clip and it looked like people from like the Renaissance Fair type thing out at some park. I don't know if you saw this, Pat. So what happened in that case, not about spoliation of evidence, is that the one guy was a necromancer and a healer, And so he took some of this glitter on a body that was beheaded, was missing the head, and he sprinkled glitter all over the scene. And so the cops came, were all hacked off because he contaminated the crime scene because all this glitter was all over the place on the body. It was a real body in a park in one of the, you know, by a lagoon or something. I don't know the full thing. And it was just like a 20-second clip, and the guy's like, "I guess I my magic didn't work." So I just,
I can imagine the cops were a bit more than hacked off. My goodness.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, the guy could be facing potential interference with the investigation. Who the hell knows? But you wonder with people. The this is an interesting case, as you mentioned, the dehydrator. I don't even know. I'm trying to picture how big this dehydrator was, but it allegedly was the defective piece at the apartment, at this dwelling. Tape was put around it, like a crime scene type of thing. Do not destroy. There was also a casing put around it so that it would be preserved. There was some questions from the three justice panel, the Indiana Appellate Court, about the timing. I think it was there was like a 6-week period or something that occurred where Michaelis was, as you said, hired to do the damage fixing, and whether there was communications from Safeco or not. This seems to be a case that there are some first party spoliation cases in Indiana that the Indiana Appellate Court and the Indiana Supreme Court have touched on. A lot of discussion of these couple of cases and whether or not, again, you can have third-party spoliation. And there was a discussion, Pat, you know, spoliation is typically a concept that's really in evidence, right? You spoil some evidence. There's questions about whether there was any indication that there would be litigation or a dispute pending here. And so a lot of questions around that.
So I got a question for you. I did not understand this concept. I'm very familiar with Illinois spoliation law, and I'll talk about that in a minute. I'm trying to figure out this. What is first-party spoliation as opposed to third-party spoliation? Either you spoiled the stuff or you didn't. I don't understand this distinction that the court and the parties were making between these two different – I didn't understand what that meant.
I rewound the oral argument once or twice because I was hoping that I was missing something in the arguments, Pat. Same thing. I don't know how you have a first party. What is first party spoliation? You destroy it yourself?
I don't know. Maybe that's what they mean, is that I destroy my and that harms the other side, whether it's the plaintiff or the defendant. I mean, you can certainly see a circumstance where a plaintiff could destroy their own stuff. And make it difficult for the defendant to defend the case. Likewise, you see a defendant destroying stuff that prevents the plaintiff from being able to prove. Is that what that is? And this is third party. That is someone who's not a party that's then being brought into the situation because they had it. And the question is, do they have a duty? Is that the distinction? That would make sense. At least I would understand what that meant.
That's again, listening, you know, as I was taking notes on the case, as I listened to oral arguments, when I rebound it, that seemed to be the distinction to me.
Okay. All right.
But I was a bit confused as well because for the same reasons you just shared. And you know, these cases, I remember a couple years ago, and I don't know who it was, may have been a colleague of mine or something. I think the microwave in that case shorted or something and burnt the kitchen, caused damage. And again, there was debates and fights about whether or not the tenant, the owner of the home, waited sufficiently to allow the insurance company to come in and determine the exact cause of the situation. So I think this happens a lot. There are a lot of questions. I think the appellant, out of the gate, I think the question was, you know, are the facts that were alleged here capable of supporting relief against Michaelis? And as you mentioned, Pat, there was confusion about the name, and then right at the beginning, one of the justices got out the correct pronunciation. The one of the things I think also in this case that's a bit of a kind of combination is that the plaintiff in this case they pled in two things. One was negligence, and one was the spoliation, and arguments about whether or not there's actually a distinction between the two causes of action here. The trial court, as you mentioned, dismissed Michaelis because they didn't see how, again, you could have, you know, any privity or any duty to the plaintiff or to the insurance company here. There was also a lot of talk, Pat. There were the few cases. There don't seem to be a lot of cases here, but one was Glotzbach, which is an employer-employee situation, and the appellant talked here about special relationships, employer-employee. I'm trying to think of the other one. Was it doctor-patient in one of the cases? And in this case, whether insurer, service repair person was a sufficient special relationship to actually come within what sounds like limited case law or limited Indiana appellate or Indiana Supreme Court kind of precedent for spoliation in general. So I think it's an interesting case. Like you said, I hopefully maybe the court, when they come out with this, will explain and confirm or refute our kind of theory of what the distinction is between first party and third party spoliation. But an interesting case.
Agreed. So Indiana law sounds a bit very distinct from Illinois law. Illinois, there is no separate cause of action for spoliation. Spoliation is a species of negligence that is derivative of the claim that underlies it. And so in this case, you would have to, there is also no distinction really between first and third party. The question is, do you have a duty? Right. And I have a hard time seeing how this entity didn't have a duty, at least under Illinois law. I my suspicion is they would be found to have a duty.
I think so.
It's you had a contract. They were given instruction. It's going to be very difficult for them, the plaintiff, to prove their case against the product manufacturer absent the device. I mean, there's a real causation problem here. I don't know how you prove the defect, whether they think it's a design or a manufacturing defect, without having the product. You know, we'll see.
And
interesting case.
And again, they have noticed because they went in there. It's kind of like the case where the park where they said, don't go over the gate or whatever. We covered, you have notice, right? It'd be like the crime scene tape, and you go and you go and move the body or something again,
or put glitter on it,
or put glitter on it.
So with that brings us to our BI for COVID. It was on life support, Dan. It's back. It's back with a vengeance this week.
Yeah.
So we have the New Hampshire Supreme Court finding for insurers, reversing the appellate court and finding for insurers. So the string of insurers winning in all the Supreme Courts, with the exception of Vermont on a motion to dismiss, and all of the courts of appeals. And then, I'm not sure how much there else is to say about that, we have what I can only describe as a bizarre decision by the Oregon Supreme Court. They get certified questions from the Ninth Circuit, and the court says no.
Right.
We're not answering those questions.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you're allowed to. I don't know why they wouldn't, but they apparently are not. Now, maybe it's that they have cases pending, and the answer is going to be forthcoming soon, and they don't need to do it. I have a hard time believing they don't have some cases in the pipeline that are their own. They don't need to answer them. Or maybe they didn't like the questions that they got from the Ninth Circuit. If you recall, the Ninth Circuit issued certified questions to both Oregon and California. I don't know if California has accepted them yet or not. But Oregon said, nope, We're not interested. As I said, they may have other cases of their own that they'll answer the question on that. They don't need to. But so that's where that stands. Usually these questions are accepted, but not this time.
No.
Which brings us to our prediction, sure to go wrong. And we are now 200. Dan is now 212, 49, and 14. I am 209, 52, and 14. We got McKenna versus Pantano that we discussed on episode 137 wrong. Dan, do you want to tell us about this case?
Sure. And this was the case that had to do with unredacted medical records under Section 10A of the Mental Health and Development Disabilities Confidentiality Act. The plaintiff had maintained that those mental health records are privileged unless the plaintiff directly puts the records at issue, or if the plaintiff affirmatively waived the protections of the act. The plaintiff claims she didn't put the records at issue, nor did she waive her rights under the act, and that the court failed to make the adequate findings for production of the medical records. The appellate court, First District, reversed the judgment of the circuit court to allow further assessment of her arguments. So,
yeah, this is really a disturbing ruling because the doctor doesn't get to rely on his own records. His experts don't get to rely on his own records. And the appellate court didn't refer to didn't address the argument made by the defendant, whether it's right or wrong. I don't know because we haven't seen the records, but those that have seen the records and they were referenced at the oral argument and apparently are in the record in unredacted form, apparently the plaintiff's expert refers to a note that includes mental health records. And that was part of the 622 affidavit. This is not the last time this case is going to be heard.
No.
Because as the court said, both an oral argument and on this opinion, that's very early in the case for them to hear it, but both sides needed to raise the issue at this stage in order to preserve their respective positions. I get why it happened at this stage, but it's very hard to wrap your brain around the idea that a doctor can't look at his own records in order to defend himself. And while at the same time, the plaintiff's expert's allowed to look at the unredacted record. If that's indeed what happened. I don't know. Maybe that didn't happen. But this is not the last time we've heard about this case. This is going to come back.
This has come back, yep.
Yeah. Either before trial, after trial, both. This case is coming back. Which brings us to our next one, Lefevre versus Ford. We talked about this over 100 episodes ago. Episode 37. Not 137. 37. This case was argued June 15th, 2021. To give you an idea how long ago that was, I was still at Pretzel and Stouffer. That's two law firms ago.
Yeah.
To give you an idea, put it even more perspective, the justice who wrote the opinion wasn't on the appellate court at the time. There's a footnote that says Justice Lance Peterson was assigned to this case. He was, I believe, a circuit court judge in Grundy County at the time. So it was a long time ago. So this is a case, for those that don't remember 2 years ago, that the defendants won a asbestos trial in Rock Island County. That's not something that happens very often. And the plaintiffs were given a new trial by the trial court, and that was affirmed by the appellate court. The defendant's lawyer apparently violated what amounted to a motion in limine regarding disclosure of documents going to be used on cross-examination and direct as evidence. He used a picture of a different product that the plaintiff's son had not seen, that to refresh his recollection. And he said, I didn't violate the rule. And let's just say neither the appellate court or the trial court bought that. And so new trial it is. 2 years after the case was argued, who knows when it was, I don't know when it was tried, but it was a long time ago. And it is quite the circumstance. Sometimes these things take a while, but this one's kind of a bit extreme in terms of how long this particular one took. So
I can't imagine we have too many cases still out from the first 50 episodes.
No, I can't imagine we do. And to the extent we do, they settled and we'd never know the result. So we reached back in the... When I saw the case come up, I was like, I recognize this case. And then I read the opinions, like, I recognize this case. And I couldn't find it. And finally, I went back in the show notes and I found, oh, okay, now I remember this. And now I did, I know I posted about this case. It's like, I remember this, it's so long ago. So we got that one right. We said it would be affirmed. It was, which brings us to one more case that I talked about when Dan was gallivanting about the greenness that is Ireland. So I didn't do predictions on this one. This is Passafume versus Jurek. This was discussed in episode 146. This is the episode that I flew solo on. I've got a lot of digesting to do on this case. This is a very strange, to my mind, a very strange situation where because the plaintiff brought a statutory cause of action for wrongful death, the usual limitation on consortium damages that end upon remarriage. This guy got remarried 15 months after his wife died and then divorced that woman 18 months thereafter. He gets loss of services damages all the way to the expected life expectancy of his deceased wife to the tune of nearly $1 million for her cleaning of the dishes, her doing of the laundry, and the vacuuming of the carpets, because that he's going to have to hire somebody else to do these and gardening and things. It's very difficult for me to understand this opinion. I've got to go back. It's a long opinion. It seems to create a circuit split, a split amongst the appellate districts, I should say, not circuit, but districts. Between the Dotson opinions and the Pfeiffer, but they rely, the court insists that it's relying on the cases from the Supreme Court. We'll see. I don't think this is the last we've seen of this one either. I think PLA will be taken on this, and I think it has a pretty good chance of being granted under the circumstances. We'll see where it turns out. But an interesting case to keep an eye on, Passafume versus Jurek, which brings us to the rule of the week. Dan, do you want to introduce this?
Sure. We should first do the predictions.
Keep forgetting that. Thank you for catching me. Gallivant's is getting affirmed.
I think so.
And I think Safeco's getting affirmed.
I think it is too.
I don't think it's the right result in terms of the way I would decide the thing. But based on what I understand, which is limited about Indiana law on this topic, it seems like it sounds like there's not a duty. But we'll see.
Yep.
Okay, now the rule of the week, Dan.
And this has to do with the new Illinois pattern instructions for the Illinois Human Rights Act, 255.00 Illinois Human Rights Act. Pat, you located this one. Why don't you tell us about these new pattern instructions?
So my former firm gets another shout-out. They posted that one of my former partners, Matt Egan, is the vice chair of the IPI committee, and he does a lot of employment work, and we now have 39 pages of IPIs on claims brought under the Illinois Human Rights Act. So there were no pattern jury instructions on this topic, and it's becoming an increasing area of litigation. As you'll see in my column this week, that will come out this coming week in the Law Bulletin. I touch on not necessarily a Human Rights Act, but increasing protections for employees from bills that have passed both chambers of the Illinois General Assembly and are now going to be headed to the governor before too long for his review and perhaps and likely signature. So this is a big deal that the new IPIs, we don't get new entirely new sections of the Illinois pattern jury instructions. If you, to give you an idea of what we don't have in Illinois, the pattern jury instructions in California are nearly 4,000 pages. The pattern jury instructions in Illinois are right around 850 or thereabouts. So there's a lot, we have a lot of catching up to do. There's a lot of things we don't have. There's a lot of times people got to make stuff up. I don't know why it is that California, maybe California has too many, but we don't have, there's a lot we don't have, I know, it seems like, in a lot of cases. So I'm oftentimes critical of that committee. I don't know the quality of these instructions. I don't know enough about this topic, but it's, at least they're there. And now practitioners and judges have something to work off of. And now we can, you can at least have something to use. The IPIs are very instructive in a lot of areas where they have summaries of when of the law, they have a comments about how they and then how the particular instruction should be used. And they're very instructive. They're oftentimes used in summary judgment. They're used as a guide as to what the law is in Illinois, because there's long discussions about what the law is, that kind of as preface to each, to the section. So it's very helpful. It's almost like an ICL. That's the Illinois Institute for Continuing Legal Education. It's like a mini ICL, but from a Supreme Court nominated committee. So people that know these things, hopefully.
Yep.
And yep. If Matt was involved in it, I know he knows these things. This is what he does. So very, very helpful and a very good contribution to Illinois law. So that's the rule of the week. So with that, we'll take our leave. Thank you, everybody, for joining us this week. We'll see you next week on the Podium and Panel Podcast.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the Podium and Panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.